In recent months, brokenness has been something of a theme for us as a church. Some of you know a lot about brokenness. And so, kintsugi, the Japanese art and philosophy, but it's an art of repairing vessels which have been naturally broken, but repairing them with a resin in which is impregnated a gold powder, has come to us to have some significant meaning. It's a picture of brokenness in God's kingdom, the way he puts us back together again. And in the art of kintsugi, you have something, a vessel like this, which is repaired, but all the cracks are mended, all the bits are filled in, so that the vessel is actually even more beautiful than it was originally. That was brokenness. This morning, God has put something on my heart that I want to share with you that you might not necessarily expect me to share, but it's very much linked to that idea of brokenness, and it's the idea of restoration. And this has come to me from a number of sources, and you can imagine where one particular source was this week that just sort of confirmed that this is what I ought to be speaking to you about. The restoration that's been spoken of this cathedral. 5 years, I am told, 5 years, the president of France has suggested it will take for them to restore it. Not sure that's wishful thinking, to be honest, but good luck to him. Hope they can. But it's not the only reason why I've been thinking about restoration. Some of you will know that at our house, we've been having some fairly major works done. We haven't had a kitchen for 6 weeks. Our kitchen is a toaster, a kettle, and a microwave oven that was bought in 1860 when they'd just been invented. It's tiny and dreadful, and the light doesn't go on, so my porridge is overheating all the time, and you can't see what's happening. We long for a new kitchen. A few more days, but that's what the kitchen looks like at the moment. It's in pieces. We long for our kitchen to be restored. And then we love the garden that we've got. We've been blessed with a lovely garden. But right now, that's the view of our garden. And we long to once more have restored God's creation as our vista instead of rubble and bricks and timber and other stuff that's not very pretty. And we long for that kind of restoration. And all those just remind me that restoration is actually what God is about. It's the longing that is on his heart, and it's therefore something of a theme in Easter. And you might be wondering, why did I talk about the prodigal son? Why am I going to mention that? Because actually, restoration is the primary theme in the prodigal son, though you might not think that that's the case. So let me go through a few things and remind you. It's appropriate to talk about restoration in the prodigal son, even though we all think of it in other ways. We think of this idea, the whole total picture of the prodigal son. Everybody knows about it. People who don't go to church have heard of the prodigal son. It's part of the language of our nation. People mention the prodigal son. But what do they mean by it? Does anyone tell me what the word prodigal means? Does anyone actually know what it means? Interesting, isn't it? We use this word, it's just natural. And very often people think, oh, the prodigal son. Prodigal is about coming back. No, it's not. Prodigal means someone who's wayward, who's lost their way, who's doing silly things, who is imprudent, who's wasteful. That's actually what prodigal means. But we've got a picture in our minds of what the prodigal son's story is. I'll put this image on the screen. This is wonderful painting that was painted many years ago that tries to capture something of the end result. But the story itself involves the youngest son of a pair of sons going to dad and saying, give me half of my, or all of my inheritance, half of your possessions, and give them to me now. And then he takes those possessions and he goes away and he spends them. He spends it, he lives the wild life and has a great old time using the inheritance that his dad has given to him. He finds himself in another land. He's doing things that we don't even want to think about that he's doing, but he's doing them. And his money suddenly disappears. Those people who'd been with him, enjoying all his riches, who he thought were friends, are no longer around. And he finds himself on his own, and he's so desperate, he has no option but to find a job, and he's working with pigs. More than that, things get so desperate, he's got so little money that he has to eat the food of the pigs. And in that situation, he finds himself saying, this is ridiculous. He's reminded of home, and he thinks, what's my father going through at this time? He's got servants. He's got hired hands who are not short of food, who've got more than I've got. I'll go back and I'll plead with him just to be one of those hired hands. And so he goes home. But before he even gets close to home, in the distance, his father sees him. And he comes out and he greets him and he welcomes him. And we've got the fatted calf. Go and kill the fatted calf. You so rarely hear these days of a family who've got a fatted calf when someone comes around. But he did. He had a fatted calf killed. He put robes on him and sandals. You can see there's a ring. He's holding a ring in his hand here to put on his finger. Hired hand, no, you're my son. And he's welcoming him back. And so he brings him back, having wrapped his arms around him to give him that status. And then in the background, you can see, but there's the older brother. Not heard much about him. He's been out in the field and he's heard, what's all this fuss about? Why is the fatted calf being killed? What's going on? And he hears that his brother, his squandering brother, is back on the scene. And he's appalled. And he won't come in. And so dad has to come out and welcome him and draw him back in. Say, no, come. Come. Your brother's back. That's the story. You all know that. What's it mean? What's the key point in it? What are the key points? Let me literally ask you the question. What are some of the notable things, surprising things perhaps, that I've told you in that story? Anybody? What are some of the things that strike you?
Love conquers everything.
Yeah, it's love from the Father. Conquers all sorts of things. Yeah. Anything else?
Forgiveness.
Definitely a theme of forgiveness. He thought he was going to come back and be the hired hand, but dad welcomes him back and actually forgives him. Yeah? Anything else?
His father gave away half of his estate in the first place.
The father, absolutely. Half of his income he gave away in the first instance. Yeah, too right. That's quite shocking. And grace.
He didn't deserve it.
He may not have deserved what was going on. Yeah. So waiting patiently, running towards him, all signs of the Father's love, a little more than you might expect. Absolutely. What would you say was the most shocking thing about this story? What's the most shocking? Maybe of all the things you've just heard. Excuse me. What was the most shocking thing? The brother. Yeah? Quite surprising, isn't it? The brother's attitude in many respects.
His brother, the one who left, spoiled everything he was given. I mean, that's to me the most shocking thing.
Yeah. It's just interesting, isn't it? I mean, the more you dig into it, it's quite interesting, the things that are shocking. Do you know, one of the things that people often say about the prodigal son story is it's a story about a son who's gone away, this idea of prodigal meaning returning eventually, the son going away, living a life where he'd got everything wrong and suddenly coming back and realizing I shouldn't be doing that and putting things right. So it's perhaps about turning an attitude around, having done things so very, very wrong, since coming to them, turning around and starting to do the right thing and coming back home again. And I suspect the church has for a long time focused on this idea that the son got things so badly wrong and God is in the business of welcoming us back when we start to do things right. It's almost this idea that many have of the church as a result of that, that it's all about rules. You get it right and you'd be welcome back, having got it so badly wrong. Do you know, I think that is absolutely a dreadful message that the church has been peddling for such a long time. The church is not about rules and getting them right. It's about what the actual big story is behind all of this. And I'm really saddened that that's what people think about the church and the message it's given. Because one of the things about that is it just teaches people to just follow rules. It teaches people to follow religion. And I've got a secret for you. I really got no more time for religion than anybody else thinks it's a waste of space. What is an interesting thing in this? Actually, the most important thing is what's actually happening about the people and their relationships. They are being restored. They're being restored. Let me read to you what one person said about what the real drama is that is going on this. The drama of this parable actually really comes into effect because of the bonds of relationship that have been damaged, that have been broken, particularly between father and son, but also between the two brothers, as has just been pointed out. This is what one commentator wrote. It is simply not possible to appreciate the significance of the actions in this parable of any of the characters without taking into account the ties of loyalty and the identity that bonds them together as a household unit and as a local community. There is so much more going on in this than we usually recognize because we are not so familiar with first century culture, which is the day in which Jesus was teaching them in that part of the world. When you start to realize what this really meant, the cultural significance that Jesus' listeners would have understood, there's a whole new message going on here, and it's about restoration. It's about the restoration of relationships. Do you know what the most scandalous thing is here in this story? We've talked about a whole series of things already. First, someone quite rightly mentioned, to ask for your inheritance, to get 50% of what your father owns and to ask for that was staggering. And the people listening to Jesus telling this parable would have understood that. This was not just asking your dad for something. This was not just dishonoring your father. It would be considered in this culture as almost criminal. You were effectively as good as wishing your father dead. Think about the significance of that. So much so that the father would have had every right by laws and customs of the time to reject his son, to throw him out completely, and to disown him. That's actually quite a shocking fact. That's what the father could have done. More than that, to sell the property that was supposed to be handed down to you from your father would itself have been a double humiliation. To take the money and then just sell it, to get rid of it, squander it, that's a double humiliation. Then something else is shocking. Leaving to go and live in another land. To go and do that and blow all of this elsewhere. That's completely shocking in this culture. You just didn't do it. And then to be so desperate to be a Jew and have to be forced to feed pigs. Can you imagine? That's almost unthinkable in this custom. And Jesus' hearers are listening to all of this. But in this honor-shame culture, have you heard of that phrase in our modern day? You might hear of it in Pakistan or in India at times. But the honor-shame thing is so strong and would have been so strong for him not to follow what the rules of the day were, for the father not to retaliate and throw his son out, would actually have been the most shocking thing of all. For Jesus, listeners, to hear him talk about this, and then talk about a father who could have gone to the law and could have followed the rules of the day, the culture, and actually ignore all of that, that would be by far the most shocking thing. Do you know the punishment for the son could have been as severe as having him killed? Did you notice one of the lines that's repeated in that story that the father uses on a couple of occasions? My son was dead, and now he is alive. In the culture of the day, he was dead. What does the father do? He sees him in the distance. He doesn't retaliate. He's not turned his back on him for all of these years. He's waited patiently. The people around him must have thought he was crazy. There was something seriously wrong. In an honor culture, that's not acceptable. But that's what the father did. And then more than that, when he sees his son, he goes running after him. This is an elderly man, and he was a man of some distinction. And he'd have had to roll his garment up and leg it, possibly with arthritis. That was shocking. That's what he did. The guy would have stunk like crazy if he'd seen me working yesterday. 12 hours cutting trees down, doing all sorts of bits and pieces. The smell was horrendous. But this guy has been feeding pigs and then has traveled back. He's probably wearing rags at this time. And he runs to him and he wraps his arms around him and he gives him the very best that it is possible to give. That, all of this, is so shocking for the people listening to Jesus. But none of these facts would have been missed for first century listeners. And then there's the brother. He's looking at this situation and he comes back and dad has thrown a party. Let me just go back to that party for a second. One of the things that this man does, this father does, is he throws a party. Now you might think, that's just lovely, he's just simply celebrating. He is. He's celebrating his son, and it's a wonderful thing. But there's something else that goes back. He's sending a message to everybody, all of his friends, who thought it was ridiculous, unacceptable that the father should let his son get away with this. And he sends out a party and he sends out invitations. People should come. I am celebrating my son. In this honor-shame culture, the father was not ashamed to welcome everybody to a party. Isn't that a picture of God? Isn't that a picture of what God has done? The reason this is a picture of Easter is that we spend our lives, the world has spent its days rejecting God, saying, I don't want anything to do with him. Thank you very much, I really need him. And God says, yeah, I understand that's what you think, but I'm not going to take the human common sense, cultural response to that and retaliate. I'm going to wait for you to come, and I'm going to wrap my arms around you, and I'm going to welcome you back, and I'm going to do something that makes it possible. And Easter is all about Jesus being given by God as his son to pay a price so that we can be restored to him. That party does something else. The son, the one who'd gone and squandered the money, has to be at it. How embarrassing is that going to be? Can you imagine sitting with all these people around you that hate you, not the father, but everyone else, that hates you. Because in their culture, in their day, you've done something so shameful. And he has to sit there. It's a celebration, but it's, you know what? It's tough justice too. It's really tough. And when we get things wrong, we don't always enjoy all the benefits of being able to wipe the past clean. We have to take those consequences. But God welcomes us back as his adopted sons. And I just want to mention then the character in the corner. Second brother. He's been working all this time. He's been out in the field and comes back and finds this shocking news of what's happened. And he's so angry. He's so appalled that his father would welcome him back after what he's done. He throws his own judgments at the situation. And he refuses to come in. Did you notice what he said to his father? He said, this son of yours. He didn't say this brother of mine. He said, this son of yours. He couldn't even think of calling him his brother. He was so angry at what his brother had done. And his father puts him right. And he very gently says, no, come my son. Everything I have got is yours. I will never stop loving you. Everything I've got is yours, and you have all of it. But understand what's been restored, the relationship with the Father. My son is back. Your brother, that's how he phrases it. He wants him to understand. Your brother was dead, and now he's alive. That's worth celebrating. What a picture of a welcome. What a picture of a father that demonstrates compassion and love in a way that human beings just couldn't. It is all about restoration, but it's about restoration of relationship. Easter is not just a story of some things, events that happened so that we could all come to church and celebrate them. It's not what God did just so that we can even look to the future. The wonderful thing about Easter, the wonderful thing about our God, is that it doesn't matter what we've done, where we've been, the state of our lives, and the mess that we've got in. He puts his arms out and he welcomes us back because his objective is not you following rules and starting to do things right after you spent years getting them wrong. He wants one thing, for you to be restored in relationship to him. That's what we were created, designed to be. And in the fall, in the Garden of Eden, when human beings first brought sin into this world, that relationship with God was broken. And it cannot be restored from anything that we do. There is nothing you can do to fix the sin that is in all human beings, that have all been born with. No degrees of sin, it's just sin. There's nothing you can do. But at Easter, God gave his Son, holy, perfect, sinless, to die on a cross. And in the process, he took on himself the sin that meant restoration could come. The message of Easter is about restoration. It's about restorative love. A love for you that doesn't just say, I think a lot about you, but that says, I have one objective, which is to welcome you back to be part of the relationship with me that you've been missing out on. Isaiah 64 verse 5 says, all of us have become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous acts are like filthy rags. Sorry if you find that in itself a little bit shocking. It's not suggesting we're all like the prodigal son. God, I look back on my life and I can think of so many things that I was wasteful in, squandered opportunities. But it's not that we're being compared like that. All the very best that we can do compared to the holiness of God is like filthy rags. That's not a good picture. But that's the reality of a broken world. But it's not the end. Because in 2 Corinthians 5 we read, therefore if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away, the new has come. Jesus took on himself all those sins, all that wrongdoing, so that we could be restored once more into relationship with God. Can you imagine a picture more stunning, more remarkable than the God of this world, whose power was to be able to put the stars into space, to create the wonder of a world around us that we see, who then gives life to human beings and says, I want to be with you. I want to know you right through this, your life. I want to guide you in everything. To then be rejected by all of us who just say, all right, Lord, I'll go it alone. I can do it myself. I don't need you. And then that God just to turn around and say, but I'm here for you. The past, forget it. The consequences we have to deal with. But there's a new hope. There's a new hope in Jesus and a relationship restored with God. That is the message of Easter. And that is the message of God. He doesn't want anybody to follow rules. He just wants you to know him. To know him as Lord and Savior. And with it, know a future, an eternal future with him. Let's just pray.